Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today grew up far from the black townships that emerged in pre-statehood Oklahoma, but she was always intrigued by her grandmother's stories of her ancestors who came to then Indian Territory after slavery and Reconstruction. In her book, Growing Up with the Country, historian Kendra Fields tells the stories of her family histories in the first 50 years after emancipation that tell a much larger story of America. Her book describes how her family fled the political and economic repression that emerged at the end of Reconstruction in Mississippi, how they came to make a home in Indian Territory, and the newly assigned lands in what would become Oklahoma. They found some economic security, only to face the same repression and violence some years later in the early days of statehood. While some resisted, others acquiesced, still others left for other promises, immigrating to Canada or Mexico, or in a couple of her ancestors' cases, participated in Marcus Garvey's Back to Africa movement. Kendra Field is an assistant professor of history at Tufts University and director of their Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. She'll be speaking about her book tonight at 6:30 at the Tulsa Historical Society, and tomorrow at a Book Smart Tulsa, Oklahoma policy event that takes place at 7 o'clock at Living Arts of Tulsa. She joins me today here on Studio Tulsa. Kendra Field, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Your book, Growing Up with the Country, tells a really interesting story that I think a lot of Oklahomans just don't hear these stories too often, and it's really an interesting piece of scholarly work, but it's your family story, but it tells a much larger story that took place in the last days of Indian Territory, Oklahoma Territory, at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. What is that story?
This story for me began with stories itself. It began with my grandmother and to some extent my father and uncles and aunts who shared stories with me as a child. And the book itself is ultimately, many years later, the story of my grandmother's grandparents' generation, what I call freedom's first generation, a generation of women and men who were, for the most part, born enslaved, children at the time of emancipation, and then came of age to witness both the rise and then the fall, the very violent fall of Reconstruction in the U.S. South, particularly in Mississippi, in this case. And towards the late 19th century, they pick up from Mississippi and head west, and they head, in fact, to Indian Territory in what becomes the state of Oklahoma. So this is a story of African-Americans kind of joining or participating in what are kind of truly become multiracial communities of various sorts in the West, in some cases participating in Indian land runs as settlers on Native land, in other cases having family histories that involve Native slaveholding, in other cases marrying into Creek and Black and Creek families and communities from the 1870s onward. So it's a complex story about race and about class and about power at the turn of the 20th century.
And also a bit about identity, too, because many of your ancestors you write about were sort of in between, and it was not sure whether they were classified as, say, a member of the Creeks, black, or sometimes white.
Right, or, you know, depending on
or
what day it was.
Mulatto,
right?
Yeah, mulatto, you know.
Right. So in that sense, it's actually not such an exceptional story. It's just precisely, you know, a 19th century story, right? But part of the larger argument I make beyond my family in the book, which draws upon many family stories beyond my own, is that this was a period in which ideas about race and color and nation are really being worked out on the ground, that nothing is really set in stone in the way that it becomes much more set in the 20th century. Right? So by the time we get to, say, 1920, the choices, say, on the federal census, right, are for the most part black or white when it comes to people in this particular family. But in the 19th century and even in the early 20th century, many of these individuals on any given census might have been categorized as mulatto or might have been categorized as black or colored or Negro or might have been categorized in some cases as white. So there's a great deal of complexity there. And then when they get to Indian Territory, of course, some of them have the ability to pass, say, for instance, when selling vegetables at, in Okmulgee, Oklahoma, and they might be passing for white, but they might be passing for Indian or it might just be left unsaid, right?
Right.
So a lot of it is very much about the kind of exigencies of the moment and about the material constraints that they're faced with.
When I think about this period in general, I think it also is a time of trying to work out these questions of race after emancipation, a huge backlash, which, of course, even predates the end of Reconstruction, but certainly after Reconstruction, huge backlash. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like it was less organized in places like Indian Territory at that time, precisely because it was the frontier?
Right. Or perceived to be, like many borderlands, right, in North America, perceived to be a place where things were a bit more flexible or malleable. And, you know, no less, not necessarily any less violent or difficult, right, but that there was some room to work in between these categories. And, of course, Oklahoma was, you know, is a relatively young state against this backdrop. And so when they arrived Indian Territory, there are rumors of quote-unquote free land in Indian Territory for many years at that point. There had been rumors that Oklahoma might become, in the 1880s, an all-black state. And there was actually a meeting that took place with President Harrison at the time to entertain this idea. Or an all-black territory, right? Of course, that doesn't come to pass, but you do have a great deal of African Americans and Black Indians who are, you know, residents of Indian Country by the 1880s and 1890s. And then when Oklahoma becomes a state, it, as you may well know, ends up adopting many of the much of the language that governed Jim Crow states of the U.S. South, for instance, Mississippi. Right. And so for many of these individuals who come here thinking this is going to be a more free place, a place where freedom may be a bit more possible, it ends up changing almost overnight. So within a matter of 4 or 5 years, many of those same individuals who migrated into the territory are looking for a way out of the state of Oklahoma. So Oklahoma has experiences its first recorded lynching Christmas Eve of its first year of statehood, and many others follow.
Yeah. Taking back to this idea of the 1880s of maybe this state becoming an all-black state, as I read a little bit of that section, and as I was reading this, I said, well, what about the Native Americans?
Mm-hmm.
You know, were they totally discounted in this discussion?
In that discussion, I would say largely yes, right? But there was, of course, there were many people vying for this land, most of them white at that point, right?
Right.
But there was some sense that because of the kind of long-standing relationships between African Americans and, in this case, the Creek, the Cherokee, the Choctaw, the Chickasaw, and the Seminole, that there might be room for such a for carving out a piece of this for African Americans. Right? I think actually part of the conversation comes from the longer history of forced Indian removal to the territory, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of circulating knowledge about that. So African Americans are looking to get out of the South in this period, and there are several leaders who are thinking maybe in the West, maybe there would be a place for us to have our own piece of land and develop and to live more freely than we can in the increasingly segregated South. So yeah, so they of course are completely part of the reality of the backdrop, but at a moment in which white settlers are vying for this land, there's also a way in which African Americans are participating in a related conversation. At the same time, you know, there's the long history and complex history of Indian Country as being both a place of potential refuge for African Americans, and this dates back to the colonial period in the southeast U.S. colonies, British colonies at that time, and then alongside that, the later history of the adoption of slaveholding by some Native peoples, a minority but nonetheless some within the Creek and the Cherokee and Chickasaw and Choctaw nations, for instance. And so there's a great deal of complexity and so much more to be understood about the complexity of relationships between African Americans and Native Americans, not only in Oklahoma, but across North American history.
Well, you tell this story through three of your ancestors. The first is Thomas Jefferson Brown. He sounded like he was among this first generation of blacks who came to Oklahoma seeking a new start, a free start, and perhaps a way, you know, a new, like every person that virtually came to Oklahoma who wasn't forcibly removed, they were coming to Oklahoma to gain a new economic start.
Right, absolutely. And so Thomas Jefferson Brown, whose mother was Irish and whose father was African-American and we believe formerly enslaved, fought in the Civil War in Arkansas, Thomas Jefferson Brown, as a kind of late teenager, migrates into Indian Territory after his father has died. And he was someone who was described as a kind of white-looking man, someone that could pass for white, potentially. And he marries, at separate points, he marries two women who are African-descended members of the Creek and Seminole nations. And one was Aurelia Bruner, and the other was Julia Simon. And as a result of those marriages, over the course of his relatively long life, his children are able to acquire land, right? So Julia Simon and Thomas Jefferson Brown have a number of children who are designated Creek by blood on the Creek rolls because of their mother's designation. And they are able to arrange for those allotments to be near each other, and they essentially acquire what amounts to about 1,000 acres of land. They build a church and a school, and they register for and receive a federal post office on the land for a short period of time in the early 1910s. So part of this is, you know, growing up, I grew up in New York, New Jersey, a million miles away, at least metaphorically. And, you know, I grew up thinking or hearing these stories from my grandmother and really having no way to really take in this information. What do you mean 1,000 acres and widespread Black and Indian land ownership? And, you know, my grandmother grew up in close proximity to the Black towns of Oklahoma, to a world in which, you know, she had Black teachers, Black principals, Black doctors, Black nurses, really, you know, a result of the Jim Crow era, but nonetheless a moment in which there was a great deal of pride in institutions within Black communities. And all of that was quite different from, you know, my own upbringing in the late 70s and 80s in New York and New Jersey. And so this has really been an opportunity for me to kind of take my, you know, intellectual curiosity and expand my historical imagination for what the past, in fact, looked like. And it looked quite different than we often read about in textbooks.
Now, in all three of these cases, it sounds like you have all this these family stories, but it was somewhat difficult to understand more than the family stories that were passed around as far as the rest of the story.
Right. And of course, a lot of times stories contain falsehoods and inaccuracies and, you know, misleading bits and pieces.
Some embellishments to make the story better.
Exactly. And erasures, most importantly for me, you know, silences and places where people don't want to talk. You know, in this case, I was writing largely about my grandmother's grandparents' generation, and there was a good deal of distance over time as well as space between their experiences and our present moment. I think had it been a more recent generation I was investigating, that would be more difficult. But I did find that over the course of my adult life, you know, ideas about this generation, about what they were up against and how they survived, changed. There was a time when it was very difficult to get any information about this generation or even subsequent generations. There was a lot of shame associated with the history of slavery itself, of enslavement. There was shame associated with the history of sexual violence, which is throughout a lot of this history. There was a lot. There were a lot of secrets, as there are, I believe, in most families, if not all. And so I became, over time, interested in storytelling and family history, really more generally, right? What stories do we tell to our children or grandchildren? What stories do we choose not to tell? It's no accident. You know, I think we tell certain stories and we omit certain others for many good reasons, whether it's to protect them or because we believe we're preparing them for the world or better preparing them for the world or to remind them of something, to fill them with pride or confidence, right? So I became interested in kind of the material circumstances and the material consequences and stakes of family history and storytelling.
Now, when Thomas Jefferson Brown came to settle what would eventually become Brownsville, northwest of Wetumpka, this acreage that he had, and he had somewhat official status, although I'm not sure if it was him or maybe his son or grandson who said, "You're always a Bruner, you're always, you know, that matriarchal line mm-hmm. that comes from the Creek side
right.
or the Seminole side, not the Thomas Jefferson Brown side." I found that really interesting. But could you give us a sense of what life was like in the 1880s and 1890s for this huge wave of migration of African Americans who came to Oklahoma during that time? Again, oftentimes it was considered the promised land, the golden land, the place where Blacks who found themselves in something, you know, only slightly less akin to slavery in the South could go and make an economic start for themselves.
Right. So approximately 100,000 African Americans migrate to Indian Territory and eventually to Oklahoma between 1890 and 1910. So that's not any small number. And most of them migrate. I mean, in the 1870s, individuals like Thomas Jefferson Brown might come in on their own, so to speak, as an individual, kind of in a model we associate most often with the earlier 19th century of pioneering. But by the time we get to the 1890s and onward, you really have whole family groups and communities and networks picking up and moving all together. So there are, you know, dozens of family members, and I have a relative in Oklahoma City who's a wonderful genealogist, and he would always say, you know, all those same families you see on the census back in Mississippi, you see all together on the same census in Oklahoma 10 years later, right? So you can really track whole communities picking up, in this case, from northeastern Mississippi or from the Mississippi Delta in other cases, and then moving on to Indian Territory in Oklahoma by the Oklahoma census, or by the U.S. Census in 1910, they're all together again, right, with a few exceptions. So there's really a collective exodus going on from the Deep South to Indian Territory for all the reasons we've talked about. And in terms of what life was like by that point, you really do have the beginnings of what becomes the Black Town Movement. So in the book, we've known for a long time because of some wonderful scholarship by Oklahoma historians going back, you know, half a century at least, of the rich history of the Black towns of Oklahoma. But there were many, many more, I think, that were not necessarily incorporated, but were incredibly vibrant places in the late 19th and early 20th century, both in Indian Territory and Oklahoma. So in the book, I document about 66, 67 such places, including, you know, well-known towns like Bully, Oklahoma, but also some communities that briefly had a post office for 5 or 10 years and were centers of activity, and where you see letters in, you know, throughout the archives with the name of those places, right? And then they disappear or seemingly disappear by 1920. So there's a whole world, I think, of Black and Black Indian community formation that is not has not yet been fully captured by, you know, the literature we've had access to or the maps we've had access to. But if you go back and look at some old railroad maps, you know, of Oklahoma, you can begin to kind of reconstruct that world. So that's part of what I did in putting, and I kind of created a map in the book that tries to capture all of that. And that also tries to capture the relationship between these Black towns and Indian country, right? These towns, you know, cropped up especially in the Creek Nation and some in the Cherokee Nation, right? And so you see, you know, if you kind of overlay the map of Indian Territory with the map of the Black towns of Oklahoma, you can begin to kind of expand your imagination for what kinds of negotiations were going on between these communities.
Well, and I guess what I was trying to get at a sense of, I was reading one line and it said, you were talking about Wetumpka, and prior to, say, the 1870s, Wetumpka had been a community of Creeks and some freedmen Creek, but literally 30 years later, it's an all-white town.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tremendous social change.
Yeah.
How does that happen? I mean, was it just systematic of white communities moving in and pushing others out, encouraging them to leave or forcing them to leave?
Mm-hmm. You know, in this case, so in the case of my own family in Brownsville, it was somewhat on the outskirts of Wetumpka, right? So there are, I do find in a lot of cases, what becomes the town, right, the center that we think of because of our later maps and our later experiences, right, wasn't necessarily a center in, you know, at the beginning, right?
And
so,
So
there's a lot going on the outskirts. There's a lot of uncertainty about what's going to become the place, right, the center place. And of course, the railroads have a great deal to do with this. You know, which towns succeed and which towns fail, whether we're talking about Black towns or white towns in early Oklahoma, often depend upon whether the railroad ends up running through them, right?
Right.
So I think that things are so much in some ways up for grabs in that earlier period that it's hard to read it the way we would other parts of the country, where there's an established, you know, for instance, predominantly white city and then it changes, or it's predominantly Black city and then it changes, right? This is a case where a great deal of the population density is in flux still.
My guest today is Kendra Tara Field. She's an assistant professor of history at Tufts University and director of their Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. She's also the author of Growing Up with a Country, Family, Race, and Nation After the Civil War, which tells her family story in a much larger social and historical context of some of her ancestors that settled in Oklahoma. It's published by Yale University Press. One of the things you alluded to earlier is how things changed for African Americans in what would become Oklahoma after statehood in 1907. Mm-hmm. The first action of the legislature was, in fact, enacting Jim Crow laws. And Was a lot of the segregation already in place by that point? Had it always been in place, or was there a time when blacks, whites, Indians lived and worked together in this area?
Yes. I mean, I think there was some degree of cooperation in the Indian Territory period. There were certainly African Americans who had come to Indian Territory as part of Indian removal, part of the Trail mm-hmm. of Tears, and were either enslaved, so human property as part of that process, or were kind of kin to others who traveled the same route. And sometimes they were both enslaved and also kin to. And so certainly that history, you know, it's been increasingly well documented over the last 10 to 20 years. Beautiful books by Taya Miles and others have documented that longer history of African American, Native American kind of cohabitation, as well as enslavement, as well as kinship and the complexities therein. I think in the kind of on the eve of statehood, you still see some degree of that kind of cooperation, partly because of the demands of the place for new settlers coming in, especially white and black settlers coming in. You are dependent upon and kind of desperate for other human beings with which to, you know, labor in the setting up of new homes and communities. And so there is some degree of kind of multiracial cooperation among those incoming settlers. There's also a great deal of, you know, kind of rightful distrust and resentment that grows, you know, very rapidly on behalf of indigenous people looking, looking out, so, you know, 70 years post-Indian removal at these newcomers coming in, right, and potentially threatening their land base. And ultimately, of course, that is the way that it goes. So there's a great deal of distrust and concern on that front. There's the whole question of, well, if Oklahoma becomes a Jim Crow state, will Native peoples be classified as white or as black, right? So there's just a lot of negotiation that goes on with everyone, and especially people who have been, you know, dispossessed by the U.S. government in various ways, Native American as well as African American, right? Trying to work out what will be our best way forward within this new state that we didn't necessarily want, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that is those are very real and understandable negotiations and sometimes battles that take place between a number of people, all of whom would have wished a different world.
Well, it sounds like after statehood, though, once segregation is passed as the law of the state, you see very rapid changes in whatever cooperation did exist. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, you do. And so you do see new lines being drawn, and you also see, you know, new communities being formed. I would say, you know, African-descended members of the Creek and the Cherokee and the Choctaw and the Chickasaw Nations become more closely connected to what were called then kind of stateside African-Americans coming in from the other states, partly because of this new kind of new forms of racialization that are taking root in institutions and in laws. In the case of my grandmother's family and many others who had come, African-Americans who had come to the territory seeking a kind of more free life, many of them end up joining emigration movements by the 1910, 1911, 1912. And one in particular takes off in Oklahoma, which becomes known later as the African Movement or as the Chief Sam Movement. And so you have, you know, hundreds of African black Oklahomans by this point who are looking to get out of Oklahoma. And some go to Canada, some go south to Mexico. But many of them join a Back to Africa movement that ends up purchasing a ship for $69,000. Out of New York, boarding that ship in Galveston, Texas, by way of Oklahoma, and you have a group of delegates that head west to, that head across the Atlantic to West Africa, particularly to the Gold Coast, present-day Ghana. So the kind of epilogue of my book is really that Back to Africa story, and it's kind of rooted, the ways in which it's rooted in the history of Oklahoma.
Now, you tell the story of three of your forebears in the book, and one of those, Alexander Davis, or Alec, he's one of the ones that go to Africa.
Right. Monroe Coleman and Alexander Davis both end up ultimately going to Africa, to West Africa. Monroe Coleman, they were both part of the Chief Sam movement, played various roles within it. Alexander Davis was, at certain points, a minister for the movement, and Monroe Coleman was one of the kind of various kinds of delegates that were assigned during the movement. And there were about 60 other people who participated, I mean, who actually boarded the ship and went on this kind of exploratory voyage.
It must have been shattering to all three of these men's dreams of seeing Oklahoma as at one point as a promised land or a place where things would be different, and to see, oh, it's just the same.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I would agree. And you know, yet at the same time, I think that's in some ways the history of, you know, the history of humanity and the history of migration, right? Which, you know, all people have faced. We often pick up from one place to another, expecting, you know, one thing, finding another, more often than not, and then pick up again. And I think there's a series of migrations. In some ways, we can tell the history of the African-American experience, you know, as a series of migrations and migrations that are connected one to the next.
The name of the book is Growing Up with a Country, Family, Race, and Nation After the Civil War. Fascinating look at this early part of Oklahoma history actually pre-state history for the most part, that took place through one person's family. Kendra Field is my guest today. What's the reaction from your family to reading this book? I assume they have to be really interested in hearing these stories. Maybe some of them it's new, some of it it's old. What's been the reaction?
I'm so glad you asked that. So my family is really behind this book in so many ways, as opposed to receiving it. So my grandmother went on almost every research trip with me back to Oklahoma. She outlived my father by 10 years, and she went back and forth with me to Oklahoma, also to Mississippi and Alabama and other locations, to collect a lot of these stories and to kind of dig into county courthouses and archives and so forth. My great uncle Clifford Fields, who grew up in Okmulgee, Oklahoma, is someone who similarly had been collecting notes on the family history going back to the 1960s and really shared with me so much of his own, you know, genealogical research over the years and then carried me forward on many of these trips as well, his brother Prentice too. So really it's been a kind of family undertaking in many ways. And over the last few years, although I did the writing myself, we did have a number of reunions in which, for instance, in 2014 we gathered over 100 descendants of the Chief Sam Back to Africa movement, and we all got together in Oklahoma and went to the place in Wilitka and Clearview, Oklahoma, where these migrants had set up camp for this Back to Africa movement and had a kind of a bit of a ceremony there. So there's been a lot of kind of collective commemoration that we've done together of this history, and that's been the most exciting part for me.
Well, Kendra, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Kendra Field is an assistant professor of history at Tufts University and director of their Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. Her book is titled Growing Up with a Country, Family, Race, and Nation After the Civil War. It's published by Yale University Press. She'll be speaking about her book tonight at 6:30 at the Tulsa Historical Society. If you can't make that, the next evening there'll be a Book Smart Tulsa OK Policy event. That's at 7 o'clock tomorrow evening at Living Arts of Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.